Trump used the word bloodbath. Cue the media meltdown. Trump is Attila the Hun. That man's Genghis Khan. He's not allowed to say bloodbath. Trump, he bathes in blood. He wants to massacre everybody. And Trump said that Jews who vote Democrat hate their religion. Of course, he's 100% right about that. And I love the fact that the media is now once again nitpicking at every word uttered by the man, because it means that Trump is winning. They are so terrified. The irony is that the media at this point, they expected a Trump bloodbath. And of course, it's going in the opposite direction and they are frantic. And did you see Chuck Schumer? Chuck Schumer, of all people, called Trump the anti-Semite. How egregious is that? Chuck Schumer is calling Trump the anti-Semite? And what does Trump need to do? How many times has he been accused of anti-Semitism? What does he need to do to prove he's not an anti-Semite? Does he need to become the first president who visits the Kaisel? Oh, wait a second. He did that. Does he need to move the Israeli embassy? Does he need to broker peace between Israel and the Arabs? Does he need to free Shalom Rabashkin? Oh, wait a second. Trump did all those things, that anti-Semite. He was the greatest friend the Jews ever had in the White House by far. And listen, getting into the bloodbath comments, the issue is not that they took Trump's words out of context, which they completely did. Trump was referring to the auto industry experiencing a bloodbath because of Biden's climate policies and losing all these American automobile jobs. But that wasn't the issue. The fact, and then they did, and it was disgraceful. They took his words out of context, but that wasn't the point. The point is, as we've said a million times, this is how Trump speaks. He uses hyperbole. He uses these vivid descriptions. And let me tell you, it is effective. And that is really why the media is so threatened. The deranged Trump haters, and we have a lot to get to. A lot of Israel news and a lot of stuff about Trump, two of our favorite topics. But they're resurfacing here, all these deranged Trump, main Trump disliking maniacs. John Bolton tweeted that Trump once said that he wants to be treated like Kim Jong-un. He wishes he could be treated. They respect Kim Jong-un. Trump wishes he could get that kind of treatment. So John Bolton is warning the country that this is what you get with Trump. The problem is, and remember, John Bolton actually worked for Trump after he said these comments, believe it or not. So what hypocrisy. But Trump made the comments about wishing he could be treated like Kim Jong-un in 2018, all the way back in 2018. So think about that for a moment. Trump was president. That was the second year of his presidency, 2018. He was still president for at least 2 years after that, 2018, 2019, 2020, maybe 3 years after that. And he did not act like Kim Jong-un, and he wasn't a dictator, and he wasn't a threat. So Bolton is literally, he's invoking a Trump comment, a comment that shows you better be prepared for the worst. And he made the comment in 2018, and he still had at least 2 years to go in his presidency, and I think he actually wasn't strong enough. All right, so coming up, like I said, a lot to get to. The Wall Street Journal published a scathing op-ed saying that Biden is treating Israel like an enemy, the way we treat our foreign enemies. I mean, if Biden would be one-tenth, if he would be a fraction as tough on Iran as he is on Israel, Iran would not have a nuclear weapon right now, not be ready to build a nuke. And an op-ed in Newsweek says that Israel has done exponentially more to minimize civilian casualties in Gaza than the U.S. ever did in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Newsweek has a stunning, stunning op-ed about the length that Israel is going to avoid civilian casualties. You'd never know this if you listen to the media. And if you listen to Biden and those Democrats, they're acting like Israel is committing genocide. And in fact, they are much, much more incredibly gracious when it comes to Gaza than United States ever was on foreign enemies. So we'll bring you those details. Washington State has lowered the requirements needed to become a lawyer. And the reason is because they want to give minorities a fair chance. You cannot make this stuff up. Washington State, you no longer need to pass the bar exam in order to become a lawyer in Washington, D.C. You can either, there's two choices. You can either pass the bar or you can be black. One of those two. I'm kidding. That part was a joke, but the rest is not a joke. They literally, Washington State has eliminated the bar exam requirement for everybody, blacks and whites. They say that the bar exam is racist. That's no joke. That's real. You can't make it up. First, they say that blacks, listen to what the Democrats say, these woke Democrats in Washington, D.C. They say that blacks are not able to pass the bar exam. The bar exam is a racist exam. It's unfairly targeting whites and not blacks. So blacks are not able to pass the bar. But then they say, oh, we're the racists. How do you figure, we're the racists? You're the one saying that black people cannot pass the bar exam. And let me tell you, the day that they give a license, a medical license to a surgeon without having to pass an exam, because they say medical exams are racist, that day I'm just giving up, okay? And we are not that far off, sadly. So we got more details about Washington State no longer requiring the bar coming up. President Biden's advisors say that he needs to walk faster. They say that in order to boost his poll numbers and in order for voters to not be worried about Biden's age, he needs to walk faster. They've gotten the solution. This is the problem. His advisors, you cannot make it up. His advisors say to have told Biden, you need to walk faster. The Biden old man shuffle that he has, because he's very slow and he's very cautious when he walks. I can't blame him. He gives people the impression that he's too old. All right, so that's why. They keep taking these polls, and all these polls show that voters overwhelmingly are concerned about Biden's age, and they think he's too old. Why? Well, let's figure this out. What is it about Biden that appears old? It's his walk. If he just goes faster, like kind of like with the speech of the State of the Union, only there they told him to talk faster. Everything with these people is, oh, he just got to speed up, just got to be faster. It's because of his walk. It's not because he forgot Kamala Harris's name. It's not because he forgot Lloyd Austin, the defense secretary's name. He can't tell the difference between Egypt and Mexico. And sometimes he'll just be in the middle of answering a question and kind of like start looking around awkwardly and forget what he was saying or who he is or where he is. No, it's not. It's his walk that's the problem. And it's not about, listen, putting the walk aside, it's not about Biden's age. Let's be very clear. The age is irrelevant because there are people 10, 15 years older than he is who are much sharper than he was even 10 years ago. But it's not even about cognitive decline. I want to be clear. Cognitive decline is a distraction. It's a smokescreen that was invented mostly by the left and by the media because they want to make it seem like his policies are acceptable and it's just his cognitive decline. And that is completely false, and it's a distraction, okay? Whoever's running the White House, I don't care about Biden's cognitive decline, honestly, because whoever's running the White House is deliberately driving the country off the abyss, which is the problem. I don't care if Biden was 103 years old, if he was unconscious half the time. If the people running the show, if they could bring down inflation, right? If they could secure the border, cut taxes, deport illegals, lock up criminals— then let them go for it, and the age would not be an issue. As long as the person in charge is doing the right thing, that's what it's about. So it has nothing to do with age or cognitive decline. It's about the fact that his policies are the absolute worst that the country has ever seen, period. All right, welcome to the Yaakov M. Show. Let me wish everybody a Freilich Purim. It's a bit early, but it's never too early to wish someone a Freilich Purim. And what a fun time of year, exciting time of year. Obviously, it's bittersweet because we still have the whole matzav going on in Eretz Yisrael. But hopefully, this should be a time of simcha for all of Klal Yisrael. We are on VIN News, Yeshiva International, Nucky Radio, 24/6. And send me an email, josh@vinnews.com, josh@vinnews.com. We have been getting a lot more emails in recent weeks, and I do read every single one of them. I've been responding to a lot of them. A lot of you make really interesting points via email. Sometimes I quote you, so keep them coming, josh@vinnews.com. All right, so Trump's comments about the Jews, and he made a comment that there's going to be a bloodbath if Biden wins. The media went totally berserk. Let me say this. Before I defend the substance of what Trump said, and everything he said is virtually spot on. Yes, he did it in his Trump-like way and a little hyperbole, a little exaggeration, you know, broad sweeping strokes. That's fine. We know what he means. I won't interpret what he means. It's fine. He's accurate. But let me just say this. I don't even care. I don't care about words, okay? I no longer care about politicians' words. Words are meaningless. Words are empty. Talk is cheap. It's about actions. It's about actions, not about words, because they get caught up in words and people interpret and people get upset. And it's meaningless to me. And I'm not talking about Chuck Schumer's words. Chuck Schumer's words were not words. I mean, he was literally totally shifting the Democrat Party's policy toward Israel, and what he said was dangerous. It was not words, it was policy. Okay, bloodbath is words. Saying that Jews who vote Democrat don't care about their religion or hate their religion is words. What Schumer was doing was saying, we don't want Bibi Netanyahu, we want new elections. That's policy, totally different. But let me just say this. In both directions, okay, I care about actions, not words. So Trump, they say that he's incendiary. I don't care anymore, okay? I don't even care if he does say the things they accuse him of saying, which he usually doesn't. He was the president for 4 years, one of the most successful presidents in history. The economy was booming. He crushed Iran. He secured the border and so much more, okay? I don't care what Trump says, even if they're right, which they're wrong. The flip side, okay, Biden. I don't care what Biden says. And what I mean is, Biden, remember, he used positive words after the attack on Israel, and it was meaningless that way. And we see his actions, which have told us that he, in fact, despises Israel. So Biden's positive words, and remember, everybody was gushing. He's such a good friend of Israel. And sure enough, what did we say at the time? We said, He doesn't mean it. He needs to say it. He has to. He has no choice. And he's saying it. He has an ulterior motive. He's doing it because he wants to be able to then control the narrative. He's doing it so that he has a seat at the table, which is exactly how it played out. And his actions have been a disgrace. So it's about actions, not words, in both directions. I don't care if somebody has good policies, good behavior, good actions, uses bad words, or vice versa. These politicians, I'm telling you, they're so phony, all of them. So Schumer, right? Chuck Schumer for 15 years has said, or 20 years has said the right words on Israel. And look at this. Number one, he stabs him in the back. But number two, he did nothing. Think about it. What has Chuck Schumer actually done for Israel in the last 15 or 20 years? Name a policy that Chuck Schumer has helped implement. It's just all been about words. And even the Iran nuclear deal, a friend of mine reminded me that the Iranian nuclear deal, okay, Chuck Schumer voted against, oh, he voted against it. No, what he did was he waited to make sure. He made sure that they had secured the vote. He made sure that it was going to pass, be ratified in the Senate, the Obama bogus Iran nuclear deal, and only then did he vote against it. So even that was fake. Now let's get down to what Trump said, okay? He used the word bloodbath, and the media literally accused him. I mean, this thing was all over the place, and I saw that he used the word, and right away, my thought went, and I didn't know the context when I saw everybody having a meltdown. I'm saying to myself, he used the word bloodbath. I use that word occasionally. And you can say, well, listen, if you're really sensitive and sensitized to what it means, and especially, you know, with all the gun violence and especially in light of the Hamas terror attack, you can tell me that it's not a sensitive thing and maybe it's better. You know, if you're really being super sensitive and super pure, do not use the word bloodbath. Okay, fine. But we know it's Trump being Trump. So my first thought was, really? The media is like making a big issue? Let's assume that he actually said literally, there's going to be a bloodbath. I'm going to grab my MAGA. If Biden wins, I'm going to grab my MAGA people and we're going to go and breach the Capitol and we're going to go and breach the White House, which is, by the way, what the pro-Hamas supporters, protesters do. They literally almost got over the fence at the White House a few weeks ago. Let's say Trump had literally said bloodbath. It's still not a big deal. But then the media had a meltdown saying that Trump is planning a massacre. That's literally what they accused him of. By the way, somebody said, oh, Trump is going to carry out a massacre. And Elon Musk responded. I think it was Joe Scarborough. And Elon Musk responded. He said, and they said, oh, January 6th, that was a massacre. And Elon Musk said, January 6th was not a massacre. Elon Musk, he's become like such a strong, you know, conservative Trump supporter. And not because of his politics being that way. He's literally been converted because the radical woke left drove him to it because he wants to embrace normalcy. But so then they watched the full clip, right? And they realized, oh, wait a second, Trump is not talking about an actual rebellion and revolt and waging a war. He's talking about the economy. He's talking about the auto industry. And Biden is sending all the auto jobs to China because of his EV policies. And what happened at that point was fascinating. Elon Musk called out Joe Scarborough, who, of course, is the morning anchor on MSNBC. So he first tweeted out, oh, Trump is calling for January 6th. He's calling for a massacre, a bloodbath. And Musk then called out Scarborough. And Elon Musk said, did you actually listen to the quote? Because the quote's talking about the auto industry. And at that point, Scarborough deleted the tweet. Wait, this is not the bad part yet. So Scarborough deletes his own tweet after he's called out by Elon Musk. It's literally, it's stunning. The drama here is just fascinating. But then Scarborough gets on television the next day and he says, well, I stand by what I said. He deleted the tweet because Musk humiliated him. And then he said, well, I stand by it. And he says, because why did Trump, yes, he was talking about the auto industry. I'll grant you that. But why did he use that word? Why is he using the word that Fidel Castro would use and Kim Jong-un would use and Mao Zedong? Can I tell you something? So now, and it's the whole week long. And then they go and they say, oh, Trump does it on purpose. He goes and specifically says words that he knows are going to trigger. He says incendiary, inflammatory comments that are going to trigger the left. The left accuses Trump of like doing this on purpose. And I contend, I'm certain of this. Trump, he has no idea. He's saying to himself, that's just how he talks. He uses the words like bloodbath. And like I say, it's vivid and graphic, and it's actually very powerful. Not powerful in the way the media says. It just, it really conjures up these good images. If you're trying to say true that Biden is going to crush the auto industry, and that's Trump's kind of his marketing skills. But like, that's just how Trump talks. But then this notion how, oh, well, you know, he's going to be a dictator. People, he was in the White House for 4 years. Okay, I actually wish he was tougher on his enemies than he was. So it's hyperbole, but it's like, it's so silly. You know, but in 2016, they wanted to threaten us and tell us how Trump taking over is going to be a disaster for the country. Okay, we had no proof otherwise. We've had 4 years of Trump. Oh, no, but this time is going to be different. This time is really, number one, it should be different. Again, I'm not suggesting that he hurt anybody, but I do want retribution because look at what they've done to him. I mean, they have destroyed the man. I'm amazed that he has so much restraint. So, like, this notion that, like, somehow, no, this time's going to be different. He's going to be a dictator. He's going to be this. He's going to be that. Like, you have to be fair enough to go by the man's track record. But like I said, don't be distracted by the silliness of the words. And the most amazing thing is, as much as the media keeps trying to, like, fearmonger and convince people, oh, Trump, he's going to be this evil dictator, people don't care. You know, a lot of voters, even independent voters, they're like, listen, dictator, massacre, bloodbath, whatever. Like, I just want somebody who's going to fix the economy and secure the border. I don't really care about all this nonsense. So it's not working. All right, the other comment, Trump said that Jews who vote Democrat hate their religion and hate Israel. And of course, he is right. And look, you want to tell me that there's the occasional from Jew, there's an occasional person who clearly loves Judaism and loves Yiddishkeit and is a from good person, Yirei Shemayim, and they happen to be misguided and they happen to vote Democrat, whatever the reason is. Obviously, there's going to be exceptions to every rule, but he's 99% right. And think about why. Because right now, if you're a from Jew, okay, if you're a Jew, if you're a Yid who cares about Yiddishkeit, and you have to pick a party, Republican, and you know how I know this? Because remember, in New York State, the Rabbanim unanimously endorsed, and the Gedolim and everybody, they unanimously endorsed Lee Zeldin over Hochul because of the issue with the yeshivas, but they clearly were ready, and that issue is going on. That issue is still raging, not just in New York, but all over the place. The Democrats are targeting yeshivas. The Democrats are targeting the frum community. So Republicans stand for, if you say, which party represents our value more closely? Now, it's a secular party. Nobody's suggesting that the Republicans are religious or that, you know, that they stand for Yiddish values per se. The question is the opposite. We have to figure out now, as a community, which party are we more aligned with? Which party is more closely aligned with our values? There's nothing to discuss. It's a no-brainer. Republicans stand for morality. They are pro-life. They fight against anti-Semitism. They want family values. They're anti-terrorist. They support freedom of religion. They defend yeshiva education. The Democrats, not only are they destroying the fabric of society, not only are they woke and immoral, but they target yeshivas. They target religion. They target from Jews. They hate it. They hate religion. They hate everything about it. And the only thing the Democrats have, really, that I can see as a redeeming factor for Jewish organizations is that they give out free money, okay? And I think that some Jewish groups are, like, afraid to slam Schumer too hard and to abandon the Democrats because they need the funds, they need the government programs, they need all that money. It's a lot of money at stake. But I'm sorry, it's really, really hard to excuse and to condone. Coming down hard on Schumer, I'm talking just like blasting him and just throwing him under the bus and saying, listen, the Jewish people no longer support anything to do with Chuck Schumer or any Democrats until there's a radical shift. So Trump is 100% right when he says that Jews who vote Democrat literally hate the religion and hate, because it's the secular Jews. It's the Jews. The ones who vote Democrat are the ones who totally have zero interest in Frumkeit, in Yiddishkeit, in the religion. Period. Okay. Yeah. They're the occasional misguided from Yiddin. I understand. Trump maybe wasn't referring to those. You know, I would have to think. Or if he was, that's not accurate. But that's not the issue here, at all. All right. And remember when Trump said that if he could shoot someone and he would still win, he could shoot someone and he'd still have support from his loyal, you know, MAGA supporters. Well, liberals are having yet another meltdown because there's a new study out. This is unreal. A new study out that says that Trump literally could shoot someone and people would still vote for him. Trump voters and even non-Trump voters would still vote for him if he shot someone at Times Square. You can't make this stuff up. And by the way, even this is being misinterpreted. They're trying to interpret this as like, oh, you see that Trump voters are maniacs, are diabolical maniacs. And that's not accurate. So here's what they literally did this. They did a study. I don't know who did this study. Some Canadian research group, and I'm sure some leftist group. And here's what they asked people. They asked all voters, then they asked Trump voters. They said, Donald Trump has said that he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue in New York City. People would still vote for him. Would Trump actually shooting someone on Fifth Avenue impact your vote? Okay, get this. Trump voters. They asked Trump voters, and Trump voters, 48% said, would not impact my vote. I'd vote for him anyway. 52% said, I would not vote for Trump. That would impact my vote. They asked all voters, and This is fascinating. 62% of all voters said it would impact my vote. 38% said, no, it would not impact my vote. So 38% of all voters, 48% of Trump voters. But once again, they're misinterpreting. Oh, look at that. You see all these Trump voters. 48% of Trump voters would vote for him if he shot a man. I mean, look at how many times he's been indicted. And clearly that didn't stop. In fact, if anything, that galvanized. But 38% of all voters. That's pretty astonishing. And again, the reason for this study is because people don't take it seriously. It's not like they're picturing him shooting somebody. What they're trying to say is, stop distracting me with the nonsense. They understand that the person asking the question has an agenda, and the agenda is, you realize Trump is evil. Look how many, 91 felony charges. Look how many times this man's been indicted. He was impeached twice. He was colluding with Russia. I mean, he was colluding with Zelensky. He's an evil man. So if he shot somebody, you'd still vote for him. And the person answering the question and saying it wouldn't impact my vote, what they're saying is, leave me alone. Stop distracting me. Biden, what I care about is the country. You know, what they're trying to say is, listen, let's say Trump would shoot somebody. Is he good for the country, bad for the country? I understand we don't want a criminal in office, which is why I want Joe Biden out of office. But that's not the point. What they're saying is, listen, it's all about, and this has always been how it's been. Politicians may not be the nicest, but what did they do for me, and what will they do for the country? What are their policies? Stop distracting me with whether they shot somebody. So as I said, John Bolton tweeted that Trump wants to be treated like North Korea's Kim Jong-un. People should get ready, because Trump, back in 2018, speaking with Fox's Steve Doocy, he literally said, here's what Trump said. He said, quote, and again, they're misinterpreting what he says. Quote, he's the head of a country, and I mean, he's the strong head. Don't let anyone think different. He speaks and his people sit up at attention. I want my people to do the same. And a couple of points here. Like I said, number one, and then Bolton, who completely turned on Trump and threw Trump under the bus after, you know, he was more than happy to work for Trump. But then they had their personal issues. And again, I'll say it a million times. John Bolton, you know, I used to have a lot of respect for John Bolton, for Nikki Haley. They were very similar. Okay, they were very, very strongly anti-Iran, developing a nuke. They were very strong on national security, anti-terrorism, secure border, all the stuff that Trump stands for. Okay, Bolton and Nikki Haley, all of Trump's policies, he carried it out better than any other person that was ever in the White House. So like Bolton and Nancy Pelosi, they should be putting Trump on a pedestal, saying, wow, nobody has ever succeeded in the things we care about, Iran and the border, national security, fighting terrorism, killing al-Baghdadi and Soleimani. And what do? They both throw him under the bus, and nobody has ever advanced the causes that they have fought for all these years. So it's just disgraceful. I'm sorry. Anyway, but what Trump is really saying there is, you know, he's talking about he admires Putin. He's not saying, I want to be like Kim Jong-un. He's saying, he's taking one aspect. This is so crucial. He's taking one aspect. He said, wow, Kim Jong-un, he's a strong leader. He garners respect. Now, does he do it because the people are afraid that he's going to shoot them? Very possibly, but that's not the point. Trump, he looks at that snapshot of, this is a man whose people respect him. This is a man, he snaps his fingers and people jump. And Trump wants to be able to mimic that, you know, presumably without threatening to shoot them down, to gun them down. But like I said, it was 2018. Bolton's telling us, oh, Trump's going to be evil. Look at this quote. That quote happened 2018, and Trump still remained in office for years after that. All right, I want to say this, and then we're going to get to some other news here. A conservative talk show host who he actually supported DeSantis, and now he came out endorsing Trump. Okay, very nice, after Trump is already basically the nominee. You know, very courageous to get up and support him, but that's not my point. So he is sitting there and he's explaining, he's saying, listen, I want you to know, you remember I supported DeSantis, but let me explain why I'm really, why I'm supporting Trump. And he goes and gives a whole explanation and diatribe and, comparing Trump's presidency to Biden's presidency. We literally know both of them right now, right? We know what Trump's presidency looks like. We know what Biden's presidency looks like. It's very rare to have two nominees, and we've seen them both as president. It's never happened, obviously, in my lifetime. So you don't need to explain. That what's amazing is he's like almost apologetic because, you know, he doesn't like Trump. He doesn't like the tweets, and he was upset about January 6th. Here you have a lot of conservatives and a lot of Republicans who abandoned Trump. They thought after January 6th, Trump was dead and buried. I can't tell you. We told you so many times, and the listeners to this show, we all knew that if Trump wants to run again, he is not finished. Okay, they always count him out, and he always has a resurgence. Like with a vengeance, but a lot of conservatives, including this one, they thought Trump was gone, so they went and decided to support others. And he's still, like, apologizing. He's, like, apologizing. Let me explain. So to me, like, he wasn't explaining why I'm taking Trump over DeSantis. DeSantis is out. This is this week. He's explaining, let me explain why I'm voting for Trump over Biden. And talks about the economy and about Afghanistan and about Iran and taxes and social programs and the migrants and the police. You don't need, and it's all true. It's all accurate. You don't need to explain. You realize how silly you sound explaining why you're supporting Trump over Biden and like apologizing and justifying. It's like saying, listen, let me explain to you why I breathe oxygen. Why am I not dunking my head right now in a fish tank of water? Why am I breathing oxygen instead of immersing my head in water and trying to breathe that? You don't need, but just when you explain it, you sound foolish. And he literally, and there's no need to apologize. And by the way, it's not about conservative versus liberal. You know, it's not like lower taxes versus higher taxes. Like there's some kind of subjective, well, there's pros and cons. We have to look at Biden's policies and compare them to Trump's policies. Inflation is still high. They literally, the Fed refuses to lower rates because inflation is still high. They keep telling us inflation is going to go down. It's gone down, but it's still high. It tells you how high it was before it went down because it's gone down and it's still too high. And economists all agree. It's an objective measure. Well, so much for them. The people on MSNBC keep telling us that the economy is in good shape. The economy is in terrible shape. And we're talking about objective metrics. I'm talking when you talk about the border and the economy and everything else. So you don't have to justify voting for Trump over Biden. In fact, the fact that you even feel the need to explain it shows that you suffer from some kind of Trump derangement syndrome. And this is the same person, by the way. He was very, very pro-COVID vaccine, and he implied that when people did not get the COVID vaccine, healthy people in their 40s, he implied that they were foolish for not getting it. Then later, when they came out with the actual research about how it didn't help and wasn't effective and it's dangerous, he said, oh, whoops, well, it's not my fault because I trusted the government when the government said that it was safe. So this is the same talk show host. Like every conspiracy theory that gets debunked after the fact, he goes and says, well, I guess that conspiracy theory was wrong, but, you know, it doesn't help. It doesn't help to wake up 2 years later. And still now, there are conspiracy theories that, you know, you're not debunking, which you should be debunking, but you're always kind of waking up after the fact. All right, a caller made the following point about Chuck Schumer. He said, you know, the real problem with Chuck Schumer saying we've got to get Bibi Netanyahu out, is because Chuck Schumer, he's anti-democracy, okay? He claims he does it in the name of democracy, these Democrats. He said, look at these Democrats, right? They don't like Trump, so what do they say? We got to disqualify Trump. We don't like Bibi. We got to disqualify Bibi. We got to get him out. If you cared about democracy, okay, democracy is in play right now, okay? So what do they really want to do? When they say they want to get people out they don't like, right? Democracy means that even if you don't like it, you have to deal with it. People have the freedom to choose things that are not good for them. So this is a great point. The Democrats, they hate democracy because they're obsessed with control. And I'll give an example, by the way. You know, I was sickened, you know, when Obama won and then when Obama won twice. I mean, I was devastated. I was crushed. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, I feared the worst and it basically came to fruition. And we're still seeing the reverberations, the repercussions. But I never, ever said, you know what, we should use a trick. It never occurred to me. Let's use some kind of trick, some kind of sneaky tactic. Let's disqualify him. Let's use some kind of 25th Amendment or something, or disqualify him for insurrection. Like, none of that stuff. There were scandals. There was Fast and Furious. There was the IRS scandal. And it was never like, okay, let's get him out. I thought maybe he should be impeached for some of the scandals, but I knew he'd never get thrown out of office. But that's a legit way. If you impeach him, that's fine. But, you know, the pitfall of democracy is that voters, like, have the ability to destroy their own country. I know it's hard to swallow. And it's like a moral dilemma for me sometimes. Like, if you're a president and the majority of people want something which you know is detrimental, well, they elected you for a reason. So you're allowed to use leeway at that point. But, you know, but yeah, people, look at this country shooting itself in the foot right now, you know, that keeps electing Democrats. And now part of that is the illegals then go and weigh the Electoral College and all of that and more congressional seats. So it gets a little complicated. But the Schumer and these Democrats, they want to control the narrative. They're literally squash democracy. Great point. All right, so Washington State, the Supreme Court there has ruled that it is no longer necessary to pass the bar exam in order to obtain a law license. They say that such a requirement, quote, disproportionately and unnecessarily blocks historically marginalized groups from entering the practice of law. So they're saying that it suppresses black people. The requirement to pass the bar exam makes it harder for black people to get a law license, and many of them do not. The court said that it's still required to offer the bar exam. When somebody wants to become a lawyer, you have to offer the bar exam. But they say the uniform bar exam is racially biased and the test is infused with racism. That's literally their words. And they even used a metaphor. They compared the legal profession in Washington State to a dam that's blocking the water and leaving people of color thirsty for more access to legal services. So I guess the people even who want lawyers, want to hire lawyers, somehow are blocked. Now, again, it's not colored people who are thirsty for water. It is the people of color, and again, thirsty for, like, the figurative water, the metaphorical water, which is legal access. So now they want to reduce barriers of entry into the legal profession, so the court authorized two experiential ways. They call it experiential ways. Experiential ways. You can get an experience that will count toward becoming having a license to practice law, and I guess they're not going to call it passing the bar anymore, but your law license comes from experiential ways. There's one of two. One way is law school graduates will apprentice under a supervising attorney for 6 months. That's comforting. The other requires law students to complete 500 hours of hands-on practical work, as well as 12 other skills credits. I mean, it's just, this is ludicrous. This is absolutely ludicrous that they're calling the bar exam racist. And the state of Oregon implemented similar measures back in November. Meanwhile, there are a bunch of other states that are doing this. Now, you'll say, well, it's just lawyers, so it's not that big a deal. It's not like a surgeon or a pilot. But they're doing this in all industries. Sooner or later, it's going to happen with doctors. It's already happening with pilots. It's terrifying. Minnesota, Nevada, South Dakota, Utah are considering alternative pathways to legal license as well. And speaking of DEI, and this insanity, right? So Elon Musk was interviewed by Don Lemon. Don Lemon, who I think went to the same school as Karim Jean-Pierre and, you know, has about the same IQ. But Don Lemon, he used to be a CNN anchor, and, you know, Elon Musk tried somehow hiring him to have a show on Twitter, but that already fell apart. It seems Don Lemon made all sorts of, like, unreasonable demands. But either way, the media tried to claim it's because Don Lemon had an interview with Musk as his first interview, as his first guest, and he grilled Musk. That is true, and he wasn't impressive, Don Lemon. He was really unimpressive. I watched a bunch of clips, but that's not why. The reports are that actually Don Lemon, he like wanted like a private jet from Elon Musk or something absurd like that. But either way, they're debating, right? So Don Lemon basically tried to turn Musk into a racist, and he used this egregious fake talking point. What happened was Elon Musk has said multiple times, he said that Boeing, the reason Boeing is so unsafe, and Musk has a lot of credibility because he has SpaceX and he has Tesla. He knows a lot about how these companies are run. So he said the reason Boeing is so unsafe is because of DEI, because they focus on diversity at the expense of safety, which is a fact, right? So Don Lemon, he's grilling Musk, right? Grilling Musk. So he says to Musk, he tells him that he's a racist. He accuses him of racism. He said, well, you're saying that blacks are not as qualified as whites to be in charge of Boeing and be in charge of safety and to run Boeing and be pilots. And Musk said back, well, pilots is, you know, airlines, but the same idea. So Musk says, I never said that. And the policy is racist. And that's the point. This is a trick. Well, Don Lemon's engaging in a classic gaslighting tactic by the left, which is what's racist here is the policy. The policy is saying, listen, blacks are not as qualified. It's saying that blacks are not as qualified. So you need to hire blacks. We're basically saying override qualifications and merit. Your hiring practices should be focused on hiring a minority. That's what the policy is saying. So Musk is criticizing a policy which is racist. Musk's not the racist. The policy is the racist, is racist because planes are crashing, right? Boeings are falling apart in midair. And Don Lemon says to Musk, oh, you're the racist. And Musk, what did Musk say? Musk said, listen, Boeing cannot sacrifice safety. That's all he said. And he held his ground. He didn't take the bait that Lemon was trying to bait him with. But what happened was Boeing, we told you about this, Boeing changed their bonus structure a couple of years ago. Their bonus structure used to be based on safety. So executives, depending on how high the safety rating was, that would be their bonus, right? One factor, and that's how it should be. Then they changed it, and now it's also based on DEI. It's based on diversity. So if you hire diverse employees at Boeing, you get a bigger bonus. Okay, now here's the question. Why do they need to change it from being safety to being diverse? Okay, if you can be safe and hire blacks, then there's no need to remove the safety incentive. You could just keep the safety incentive and tell people hire more blacks. So what they're saying is that safety is not our number one priority because diversity is an equal or greater priority. Okay, hiring blacks is the priority. So implicit in the policy is you cannot have both. That's what the policy is saying. It's saying that you either choose safety or you choose minorities. You cannot have both. There's a clash. Musk says, and he's right, he says Boeing should focus on one factor, safety. DEI should never, ever be enter into the equation. And Don Lemon says, well, you're a racist. Why are you implying that blacks cannot be qualified? Musk didn't take the bait. He said, no, I never said that. I said, stop giving bonuses for DEI and diversity. And, you know, that's great, okay? And hire as many black people as you want, as long as you keep the focus on safety. And it's fascinating. These liberals, they are, I mean, they are just such a bunch of creepy weasels. I'm sorry. Peter Navarro is in prison. He reported to prison, and it is so disgraceful. Peter Navarro, you have to realize what he was. The crime he's guilty of, that he's in prison, and it's on appeal, but they're still forcing him to serve out a sentence, is the same exact thing Hunter Biden did. He defied a congressional subpoena, okay? And many, many, Eric Holder did this, and Rod Rosenstein, so many people on the left have defied these congressional subpoenas, and they get held to contempt of Congress, and they never, ever go to jail or even get charged with a crime. Peter Navarro, we're not talking about some, like, low-level staffer. He was a top official. He was a top official in the White House. He helped crush China. He helped Trump on trade with so many negotiations and tariffs. Peter Navarro was a top White House official, and he's wearing an orange jumpsuit down in Florida, and the Democrats are gloating, and he did what Hunter Biden did, only what Hunter Biden did was much, much, much worse, because Hunter Biden is accused of so many crimes. I mean, really massive corruption. Peter Navarro, he defied his January 6th subpoena. It was a bogus committee. And Navarro, he said, I'm invoking executive privilege. He did nothing wrong. We got to get to the Israel stuff. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. Wow, it's late here. He says that Bibi Netanyahu has agreed to send a team over to hear Biden's concerns about the Rafah operation, even though it's happening. And here's what he said, Jake Sullivan. Hamas should not be allowed a safe haven in Rafah, but a major ground operation there would be a mistake. Okay, so again, nonsensical drivel from Jake Sullivan. Hamas should not be allowed a safe haven in Rafah, but a major ground operation there would be a mistake. Well, which one is it? You can't have both. And it makes no sense, and he knows it. Sullivan also actually invoked something people are saying is classic textbook anti-Semitism, because Sullivan said he accused Bibi Netanyahu. He said Bibi Netanyahu is accusing Schumer of interfering with Israeli politics. That's ironic, because Bibi interfered with U.S. politics. He does it all the time. Didn't specify what he's referring to, and it's not true. Bibi Netanyahu never interferes with U.S. politics. There's no instance on record. He's been in charge forever in Israel, in power for years and years. And it was a lie, and it's actually an anti-Semitic tactic where they accuse Jews in foreign countries of interfering with domestic politics. Didn't happen at all. But all right, let me get into, like I said, two op-eds, really, really powerful op-eds here about Israel. So one, a scathing op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying that Biden is treating Israel literally like an enemy. Here you have Iran getting the red carpet treatment, and they treat Israel like an enemy state, almost like the way Reagan treated the Soviets. They are squeezing Israel. Now you have Canada that refuses to suspend all arms and weapons deliveries, shipments to Israel, which is a disgrace. And you have Canada now, they're supporting UNRWA, and they're continuing their funding to UNRWA. At least give credit to Biden. As of now, they're not funding UNRWA, even though I expect that to change before November. We'll see. I know they announced that technically they suspended it for a year, but I'm skeptical. We'll see what happens. But, you know, again, the fact that they say it means virtually nothing. But it's incredible how Biden is now doing everything he can to hamper Israel. So let me read you here, the Wall Street Journal, quote, last Monday's release of a U.S. intelligence assessment casting doubt on the political viability of Mr. Netanyahu's wartime leadership and predicting large protests against him was highly unusual. That's how the U.S. once treated enemy dictatorships, not allied democracies. Interjecting here, I just want to point out they're referring to, there was actually a leaked intel report where intel officials supposedly say that Netanyahu is in danger and his coalition is in danger of collapse. Whether that's true or fabricated, that intel assessment, the fact that it was leaked, the fact that they're even having that conversation is egregious. Like the journal saying, they do that with enemies, not with their allies. Back to the journal, quote, Mr. Biden has endorsed Senator Schumer's extraordinary declaration that Israelis must depose the elected Mr. Netanyahu while the Democrats are piling on. Even more serious are delays in U.S. weapons transfers, leaked threats to cut off arms, and the Biden administration's efforts to discourage other countries from exporting weapons to Jerusalem. Ammunition supplies are a major concern, but Israel's existential nerve has not been touched, end quote. So, I mean, they literally are squeezing Israel, putting the pressure on, the worst predictions that we made are coming to fruition. All right, let me get to this Newsweek article because this is fascinating. This is a military expert and an urban warfare expert. He says Israel has done far more to prevent civilian deaths than any military in history. And this war is much harder to fight because of the urban warfare, because it's taking place in these very, very densely populated cities where Hamas is entrenched. So let me read you. This article is by John Spencer. He's the chair of urban warfare studies at the Modern War Institute at West Point. And he says Israel has taken more measures to avoid needless civilian harm than virtually any nation that has ever fought an urban war. He said, in fact, as someone who has served two tours in Iraq and studied urban warfare for over a decade, Israel has taken precautionary measures that even the United States did not do in Iraq and Afghanistan. So here are the points he makes, and this is so fascinating. Number one, he says that the use of PGMs, precision-guided munitions. By the way, he says, I say this not to put Israel on a pedestal or to diminish the human suffering of Gazans, but rather to correct a number of misinterpretations when it comes to urban warfare. So he's just saying this in the interest of being accuracy. He's not even trying to defend Israel. And he says, quote, it's more like he's defending urban warfare than defending Israel. But he says that PGMs, precision-guided munitions, he says in the Gulf War, only a very small fraction of the weapons used were PGMs. He says, let's compare that war, which did not ignite anywhere near the same level of outrage, to Israel's war in Gaza. The IDF has used many types of PGM to avoid civilian harm, including munitions like small diameter bombs, as well as technology and tactics that increase the accuracy of non-PGMs. And Israel has employed a tactic when a military has air supremacy called dive bombing. All this creates more pinpoint targeted, all this is to do more pinpoint targeted attacks to avoid civilian deaths. In other words, the simplistic notion that a military must use more PGMs versus non-PGMs in a war is false. So, interesting. Essentially, I mean, he's saying that Israel is going above and beyond in terms of using the PGMs. And then he says, one of the best ways to prevent civilian casualties in urban warfare is to provide warning and evacuate urban areas before the full air and ground attack commences. This tactic is unpopular for obvious reasons. It alerts the enemy and provides them the military advantage to prepare for the attack. The U.S. did not do this ahead of its initial invasion of Iraq in 2003, which involved major urban battles, including in Baghdad. It did not do this before the Battle of Fallujah in 2004. By contrast, Israel provided days and then weeks of warnings, as well as time for civilians to evacuate multiple cities in northern Gaza before starting the main air-ground attack of urban areas. The IDF employed calling and texting ahead of an airstrike, as well as roof knocking, where they drop small munitions on the roof of a building, notifying everyone to evacuate before the strike. No military has ever implemented any of these practices in war before. The IDF has also airdropped flyers to give civilian instructions on when and how to evacuate, including safe corridors. Israel has dropped over 520,000 pamphlets broadcast over radio through social media messages to provide instruction for civilians to leave combat areas. By the way, I was not aware of a lot of this. You know, I'm not shocked, and I knew they used some of these tactics, but the level of detail is totally being buried by the media. Quote, Israel's use of real phone calls to civilians in combat areas, 19,734. SMS texts, 64,399. Pre-recorded calls, almost 6 million. To provide instructions on evacuations is also unprecedented. The IDF also conducted daily four-hour pauses over multiple consecutive days to allow civilians to leave active combat areas. While pauses for civilian evacuations after a war has started is not completely new, the frequency and predictability of these in Gaza has been historic. Another historical first in war measures to prevent civilian casualty was Israel's distribution of IDF military maps and urban warfare graphics to assist civilians with day-to-day evacuations and alerting them where the IDF will be operating. So they're literally telling their enemy where the operation is going to take place just to let civilians go. Unbelievable, the graciousness. And they get no credit. They're accused of genocide. Quote, the reality is no military in history has ever done this. The reality is when it comes to avoiding civilian harm, there is no modern comparison to Israel's war against Hamas. Israel is not fighting a battle like Fallujah, Mosul, or Raqqa. It is fighting a war involving synchronous major urban battles. No military in modern history has faced over 30,000 urban defenders in more than seven cities using human shields, hiding in hundreds of miles of underground networks purposely built under civilian sites while holding hundreds of hostages. Despite the unique challenges, Israel has implemented more measures to prevent civilian casualties than any other military in history. The sole reason for civilian deaths in Gaza is Hamas. Unbelievable piece. A Hezbollah terrorist, unbelievable. Hezbollah terrorist has been caught crossing the border illegally into the U.S., and he was plotting a terror attack. Basil Ebadi was caught by Border Patrol March 9th near El Paso. He was asked what he was doing in the U.S., and he said, quote, I'm going to try to make a bomb. This is a Hezbollah terrorist. Ebadi said he had trained with Hezbollah for 7 years in a sworn interview and served as an active member guarding weapons locations for another 4 years. Unbelievable. His focus was on jihad and killing people, not Muslim. A Hezbollah terrorist gets across the border thanks to Biden. We have a lot more to get to, but I think we're going to... All right, one more story over here. The United States has just evacuated its embassy in Haiti. There's a major, major crisis going on in Haiti. It's total anarchy and chaos. And now the Biden administration has presided over 11 embassy evacuations. 11. That is more than any other presidential administration in U.S. history. And think about this. And it's all Biden. It's all Biden. The world's on fire. The world's falling apart. It's all Biden. And think about this. Biden's only been president for 3.5 years, okay? More 11 evacuations, more than any president in history, any administration. That includes 8 years. 8 years under Obama, under Clinton, under Reagan, under Bush. 8-year terms. And Biden's only 3.5 years in because his presidency is a total disaster. I don't want to end on a negative note here. So Purim is coming. And Bezus Hashem, I hope everybody has a very freilicha and a very healthy and safe Purim. And, you know, we look forward, Bezus Hashem, to, you know, Simchas and hopefully Yeshua's and Klal Yisrael. That's going to do it for today. And we will see you next time.